my attitude is that when you're giving a keynote, you ought to make at least half the audience really mad. So my goal here is actually to incite controversy, and ideally discussion. So if I end up talking less and we end up talking as a group more, that's better, because I think we have a serious problem. And my goal is to get us actually all thinking about that. So if you aren't mad, I've failed. But I'm going to try to make you all mad. So one part of the introduction that I think is relevant is that I actually like to do stuff that matters. So I built this stupid little hash package in graduate school, but it ultimately became a product and a company. And I think as a systems person, it's really important that we actually do things that matter. So thus, the title of the talk is World Domination Through Provenance, because if we're going to do provenance, we should aspire for no less than world domination. And if you're not interested in aspiring for world domination, then, you know, go do something else. So let's start out by figuring out what world domination should look like. So what should happen is that when you're talking and you say provenance, this is the reaction you get. How many of you get this reaction when you say I do provenance? Okay. What else might it look like? So, you know, poor Val often forgets where his data came from, and he says, where does this came from? And if, in fact, we had been successful and dominated the world, then his computer would say, oh, that was the note from the department chair yesterday marked urgent, and Val would know that he should deal with it. Now, I actually sometimes work with students on papers, and they often work from, like, 2 in the afternoon till 5 in the morning, and I tend to work from 6 in the morning until they get up. So we don't often overlap, unfortunately, and so it is not uncommon for me to have this experience where I show up and the paper doesn't compile and the graphs are wrong and everything I wrote the day before suddenly doesn't make sense, and I would kind of like to back that out. So I want, you know, if we had achieved world domination when this happened, then in fact not only would my computer system tell me what had gone wrong, it would send mail to my student and tell him what he'd done wrong too. He doesn't know that slide's in here, so shh. What else might it look like? So maybe some of you remember the financial crisis and traders were wondering what risk profiles look like. That's the answer we wanted them to see. I don't think that's the answer they saw. And finally, right, a picture of Peter Buneman when he says, I work on provenance. This is the reaction we should have, in fact, if we'd achieve world domination. So this is what I aspire to. Or I aspire Peter to this.
I need a copy.
They're for sale. Well, so interestingly, Peter and I exchanged some email on this topic, and I'll talk more about that offline. But so let's look at what the world looks like today. This is the world we aspire to if we want world domination. So you say you work on provenance, and people look at you and think, what? Val says, where's this file come from? And his poor computer says, I don't know, you got it yesterday. It's about the best it can do. When this happens to me, we miss paper deadlines. That's not good. And we know what happened in the financial crisis when they asked about the risk profile. They said, oh, no problem. And poor Peter, when he says that, you know, I do provenance, you know, this is the reaction we get. So I pose the question, have we achieved world domination? I think not. So that's what I want to talk about. Why, where are we, and why haven't we achieved world domination? And I'm going to speculate wildly on some possible explanations. I don't claim that they're right, but I want to, you know, inspire some thought. But what I actually want to do is engage all of you in thinking about why the not. Provenance is actually really important. We all believe that, or we wouldn't be working on it. And yet, if we start to look at our impact, let's think about what impact we've had. So we've had some papers published. It's hard to get an exact count, actually, but we've had some published. Peter Buneman, you know, wrote that wonderful paper sort of getting us thinking about this formally, and it has somewhere on the order of 720 citations. It's not bad. It's not what some of these other papers in other fields get. Oh, but we have a lot of standards. There are 13 that I could count. We have zero New York Times headlines that I could find that have anything to do with provenance. I put a one with a question mark in products. So I'll actually talk about that, because the irony is that the product I'm referring to is called Total Recall, and it's a product by Oracle, where I actually work. So you would think I would know something about this, but I actually learned about this product at TAP 2 years ago when there was another Oracle person there who said, oh, we do provenance. Scratch my head, so that's very interesting. And actually, when I gave my first provenance talk at Oracle, a bunch of the Oracle database engineers said, oh, yeah, we do that. It's funny. So I started poking around. And what they do is kind of interesting, and maybe in like some parallel universe we could say they do provenance. But don't tell them, we don't. What Oracle does in their total recall is they actually save the undo logs, and then they later go back and process them and let you do flashback in time. So you can, in fact, say, if I'd issued this query 3 years ago, what would I have gotten? And that's a great feature. It's really useful. Not exactly provenance. It's kind of related to provenance. But because I didn't want to put a zero here, too, I gave it a 1. So we could argue it, but it's not a 10. It's not a 100, and it's not a dot-com boom. So that's the takeaway there. And how many Turing Awards? Well, we don't have any of those yet either. So those are some metrics that we might measure impact by. So where would we like to be? So some of you might know I gave the keynote at TAP 4 years ago. So that was 2009. And what I did was I gave a retrospective, i.e. what would it look like if it were 2019, and where would we be, and what would we have accomplished? So as one metric, here's what I wanted to see us for attendance. So by 2014, that's next year, we were supposed to have become the Theory and Practice of Provenance Symposium, attracting 350 people with 100 submissions and lots of energy and lots of enthusiasm, because by 2019, we were going to be the Federated Provenance Conference. And we've got a lot of work to do before we get here, right? How many people here represent a major hardware vendor? How many people here represent a major software vendor? How many people here are from research universities? Okay, how many from research labs? Okay, so we're all doing research. That's good. If we want to have impact, these people need to care. They're not here. They don't care. About us, at least. So I claim we have a problem, the collective we. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to pick on everybody, myself included. So it's equal opportunity abuse coming out. Are people mad yet? All right, I'll keep going then. So here's some speculations about what the problem might be. Maybe we just picked the wrong topic. Maybe people just don't care about provenance. That would be unfortunate. We'd all pack up and go home. Maybe it's like security. Lots of people do research on security, and we still have internet meltdowns and bugs and viruses, and the problem is that everybody wants security, but they're not willing to pay for it. But there's a much more vibrant security community than there is provenance community, so even if that's the answer, we can do better. Maybe this idea of general provenance, like, is a all-encompassing, maybe that's the problem. Maybe we need to be more focused. Or maybe provenance is more like insurance. You don't know you want it until it's too late. I'm going to talk about each of these in more detail. Or maybe, just maybe, we're giving them the wrong thing. So let's look at each of these in detail. People don't care about provenance. I went to a workshop at Library of Congress, and I gave my sort of evangelical provenance spiel, because I actually really believe in this stuff. And I wouldn't be here if I didn't. I'm totally convinced that every hardware and software vendor in the world should be building products with provenance. But they're not, and that's our fault. So I went to LOC to talk about provenance. They said, oh my God, we would love to have that. And all the people from the Library of Congress are sitting in the room going, oh yeah, yeah, and they're nodding and they're getting really excited. So they care. I was talking with somebody who manages big science at Google, and he said, oh, wow, this would be really interesting. Would be really interesting. So where we are is not yet interesting, but there's potential. So that's good. Somebody who does compliance is complaining that doing lifecycle management is a real pain in the butt because you have to keep track of how old these documents are and where they come from. He really wants this. Hello. My battery just died. That would be good. That'll teach me. Either that or something else is going on, because now the keyboard isn't working either. Oh, this is really fun. Okay, there we go. Okay, so there's some folks at the Harvard Forest, and we've met with them a number of times about what they want from provenance. and their aspirations are so low, and we still don't give it to them. So they have Excel spreadsheets. They have real data in Excel spreadsheets. They like their Excel spreadsheets. We're not going to make fun of them for that. That's what they put their scientific data in. But sometimes they export it into CSVs. And once they've done that, there's no connection between their CSV and their spreadsheet unless they name it correctly and follow it around. They would love to have Providence that actually tracked that. Their aspirations are so low. I wanted to give them a macro. I still haven't gotten around to it. My bad. Not their bad, my bad. Computers don't work. All right. A friend of mine, so this was actually a funny story. So this is a former computer scientist, a database person who switched careers and became a systems biologist or computational biologist. I don't know exactly the difference. And one day he was managing all these various different data pipelines and data flows, and he realized he needed Providence, desperately wanted Providence. So he went on the web and searched for Providence, and lo and behold, he recognized a name because we had worked together 20 years ago, and so he called me up and said, you know, we desperately need Providence, what can you do for me? And we talked and we went back and forth, and the bottom line was that at the moment we couldn't do anything for him. He had a real need, he needed it, and the only thing we could do is build a custom solution. This is not good. It's definitely not good. And then I recently ran across a guy named Greg Wilson who runs Software Carpentry, and he runs all these workshops for researchers and trying to help them learn how to do computational research better. And they were looking for possible entry-level Providence tools. And the best they could find was our library. And I say that with a little skepticism because it's mine, but if that's the best we can do, we're not there yet. So, people do care. People want Providence desperately. So I don't think that's the problem. Maybe people want it, but they won't pay for it. Well, it's possible that that's an excuse, but we haven't really run the experiment because we really don't have any products for them to buy. So we don't know this, so I don't think we can use this as an excuse. We can try, but it doesn't hold water. Maybe the problem is that we are computer scientists, and we like to think generally and about abstractions, and we've been doing a really good job of that, and so we've been coming up with all these general purpose provenance solutions. And maybe the truth of the matter is that's not going to cut it. Maybe we actually need to be more tailored and more specific and actually build one-off solutions that work for different people until we learn how to build something general that works for more than one person. Wouldn't be glamorous, but it might be true. Is there evidence that? So I've been dabbling around a lot in medical informatics and healthcare, which is a whole other nightmare. But it's a very, very vertically integrated field. There are the 800-pound gorillas. They don't play well with others. There is some government mandate suggesting that maybe they will have to play with others. But there are some pretty entrenched users there. And they're not going to change their tools, and it's pretty well dominated. So that's a case where if you're going to do something, you have to just play in their sandbox. There's really no other choice. And the other thing is people are pretty much tied to their tool sets. So there are people who use R. Coming to them with a solution in Python doesn't work. Similarly, there are people who use Python, and coming to them with a solution in R doesn't work. So people are pretty tied to their own tool sets. So maybe we need to do better in this front. I would give that a definite maybe. Providence is insurance. So if you think about it, when you collect Providence, it's pure overhead. Right. There's no immediate benefit to a user. It costs them space, and it might cost them time or performance. They only care about it after the fact. So there is an element of insurance to Providence. Well, let's look at insurance. What makes people buy insurance? By and large, people buy insurance when they're required to. If you want to drive an automobile in this country, you must have auto insurance. Most people have homeowners insurance, not because they sat down one day and said, I'm really going to buy homeowners insurance. Most people have homeowners insurance because they have mortgages on their homes, and the mortgage company requires that you have homeowners insurance. So let's look at a market where people aren't required to buy insurance. Renter's insurance. Anybody in the room rent? Anybody have renter's insurance? That's pretty high. That's 50%. The penetration is something like 20 to 30% of people who rent buy renter's insurance. So we're a very careful, reflective group, and I'm glad to hear that. But maybe provenance is renter's insurance. And if that's the case, what are the implications? If we want world domination, and like I said, I want world domination for us, what does it mean if we're the renter's insurance of the digital world? That means that we actually need to sell not to the end users, we need to get it into products so it's always there and they get it for free. So we need to kind of slip it in under the back door. Do I see skepticism back there? You can like feel free to interrupt and ask questions. No? Okay. I thought that. Yes?
In favor.
In favor. Okay. So we are...
Did you comment, though, on what you mean by entry-level provenance?
So I think what... So I've followed up with Greg on this, and I think what they mean by entry-level is really this total transparency and sneaking it in under the covers. And so, for example, I can tell you how the conversation has gone, and I think this provides insight into it. So we came back and said, well, yeah, we have the library. You can link it into your application. And he said, well, what about when they move files around on the command line? We said, oh, no, we've got a solution for that, too, because you can actually, you know, wrap your command scripts in our commands, and it will keep provenance. And we thought, it's like, yeah, this is great. We're really going to have some users. And he said, oh, they're never going to do that. So I think what he meant by entry level is a combination of sort of this problem and the other, which is I want to do my job exactly as I do it and still be able to ask the questions after. So I think that's what they mean by entry level is I don't need to know nothing. Makes our job tougher. Absolutely makes our job tougher. By the way, you should all feel free to like jump up, tell me I'm wrong, agree, disagree, whatever. Inciting controversy is a good thing. So please don't wait till the end of the talk. You're free to comment at any time. Maybe we're giving them the wrong thing. So this is where I get to bash on everybody, myself included. So we gave them a fragile kernel module, which sometimes maybe sort of kind of works on a good day, if you install it correctly. So, you know, I'm really not trying to be arrogant here, but to our credit, the good side is once it was installed, we wanted it to be invisible, and I think we got that part right. But the thing we have is really A, it's fragile. B, it's an old version of the operating system, because have you ever tried to keep operating system code up to date with every new release? It's really hard. And getting graduate students to do that work is actually really hard. So we kind of dropped the ball, and we never got it up to a level where you would actually really want to run it day to day. So we didn't do that, and then we gave them a library, which sounded appealing, but didn't really solve their problem. Other people have given them workflow engines, and workflow engines are wonderful things, but they're workflow engines, not provenance systems, even if they do capture provenance. We offer them relational databases. So these are the things we've given them, but you know, nobody likes fragility, you know, number one, and nobody really likes kernel modules, to be perfectly honest. Nobody really wants to install. If it was truly, truly valuable, and it worked, and it didn't have any bugs, maybe. But they don't want them. Libraries aren't bad if you know you need the library and know enough to look for it, but, repeat after me, provenance is insurance. If you only go look for the provenance library after you've lost your critical data or forgotten how you generated it, it's too late. So, fine, it's not a bad delivery mechanism, but you need to deliver it. And unless people are looking for it, you can't deliver it. Okay, workflow engines are wonderful tools. They are fabulous. And people use them as workflow engines. I don't know how much they use them as provenance systems, even though we give them provenance. And there are people who want provenance who aren't using workflow systems. Okay, and then there's the database people. So we like to talk a lot about reproducibility in science. By and large, scientists don't use databases. They have these really big flat files. It's not that they think databases are bad or evil, they just don't use them. So we're not really helping scientists when we give them databases. So there's a little bit of a mismatch between the kinds of things we're doing and the kinds of things real users want. That's my assessment. So as I look down this list of how we're doing, you know, people don't care about provenance? Definitely not. That one is absolutely not the reason. People care, they care a lot, and they want it. Security? Maybe, but we don't even know enough, right? I'd be thrilled if we got to the point where we actually knew that was the problem, but we're not there yet. Maybe, I don't know. It could be that everybody needs their own personal solution, and it may be that what we need to do is tackle really specific one-point solutions where we can get users and then generalize. That wouldn't be a bad idea. The insurance, yeah, I think that's probably likely. And so that means strategically we need to be wily. And that's okay, wily's fun. We're giving them the wrong thing. I think probably this is the case. And I stand guilty as anyone else, if not more so. Totally willing to take the blame. But also very, very much interested in trying to fix it. So what should we give people? So this is the happy part of the talk. This is it. I think it's not hopeless. We could actually give them good things. So let's talk about what we might give them. And I'll talk about each of these in more detail. So how many of you have actually used your own provenance systems for doing something other than writing the paper about your own provenance system? Okay, there are a couple hands. That's good. It's more than I expected. It's not everybody. Okay, we'll get to that. We should give them solutions, not tools. I'm a huge fan of tools. I am like the biggest evangelist of the Unix tool-based philosophy and all this other stuff. But maybe we need to give them solutions and not tools. We'll talk about that more. I think we need to give them friendly interfaces. And friendly interfaces doesn't necessarily mean a GUI. We'll talk more about that. We need to think long term. We'll come back to that. This insurance thing is tough. I think it's real, but we need to think about it. And we need to actually be willing to support users and actually help them. And we need to be open-minded. So the embarrassing part, so now this is the true confessions part of the talk. The embarrassing part of this next section is that a lot of the stuff in this came from a study we did in 2007, like 6 years ago. I had an undergraduate who is truly brilliant. She didn't know it at the time, which was even more fun. She does now. But she did a shadow study over the summer. I hired her to actually follow people around and figure out what their provenance needs were. And it's interesting because for a short time we really used that to focus our work, and then somehow, I guess she graduated, but it filtered away and became sort of less focused. And now looking back, I feel really bad about it because I think there were some real gems in there. So a lot of the quotes I'm giving you are actually directly from this study that we did. It's information we knew. And like I said, I'm totally willing to take blame here, but I think as a community, we all are going to share that blame too. But you know, I feel like an idiot for having missed some of this stuff as well. So there's an expression called eating your own dog food. And this really came home when, so the same student who built our core provenance library, right, this general purpose provenance solution, you could use it with anything, yada, yada, yada. So the same student who did that, very smart guy, love him to death, was then working on a project that was generating reams and reams of performance data, like a lot. And we sort of got ourselves in this mess where it's like, well, which data did we use to produce this particular paper? I think it's this one. I think. And then I stopped for a moment. I said, wait, and there's one other piece of the puzzle. And then at some point he came and he said, you know, these people who said they wanted this particular language binding in the core provenance library, I gave it to them and they're not using it. And, you know, how do we get people to use it? And I looked at him and I said, are you using it? He said, no. Really? And why would that be? And he didn't have a good answer. I would like to say I'm so much better at this. I'm a little better, okay? So I had a sabbatical and I was doing a bunch of data processing. And right before I got ready to sort of launch the large scale experiment where I was gonna pull down a lot of data, I said, wait, I'm going to want provenance. Well, actually, no, I did a little bit better than that. I even captured provenance while I went out. I did a rub crawl and I had a little database that had like where everything came from. So it wasn't a provenance store, but it was really provenance. And then I said, but wait, I have the core provenance library. And it doesn't have Python bindings. So I sat down and I wrote Python bindings for it. And I was all ready to do the massive launch. And then my sabbatical ended, so I haven't actually used it yet. But at least I thought about it. And I felt pretty good about that because, you know, that was one step beyond doing nothing. Wasn't quite there yet, but it's getting there. So we need to actually use our own tools, right? How many of you have ever written a paper that involved a lot of data? How many of you actually captured provenance of all that data? Okay, we are provenance researchers. We don't use our own tools. how on earth can we convince the rest of the world that this is important and they should use these things if we don't use them ourselves? I think this is probably the number one thing we need to do, because you know what? The first user, even if it's you, uncovers all the things you didn't think of and all the things you did wrong and all the features that are missing, and it's very, very informative. So I think we need to use our own tools, and I don't think we do that very well. So it will be buggy, and if we use our own tools, we will fix the bugs. And that gets us to giving our customers, an interesting word to use, or our collaborators, tools that actually work better. So we need to do this. So what do I mean by solutions that work for users? So these are a couple quotes from that study. And I thought the first one, we all want to work with, you know, whether it's domain scientists or librarians or whoever that want our provenance, and yet it's actually a struggle. You have to work hard to make sure you're communicating effectively. And so we need to be willing to buy into that. And then this gets back to the issue that Val raised, which is our job is to do provenance. So we think provenance is great, and we're willing to spend like as much time playing with it and dealing with it and collecting it and querying it as we want. But the people who we want to use our provenance systems, they don't eat, live, and breathe provenance. They eat, live, and breathe their domain, physics, astrophysics, libraries, whatever. So they really don't want to invest any effort. It's just kind of got to work. So we need to have that in the back of our heads when we build these things. I think what that means is that we need to come to them where they work. So how many of you have learned a new language in the past year? Wow, that's really good. How many of you have started using a new text editor in the last year? Wow. What'd you start using? I'm curious. Come on. Okay, cool. How many of you, let's see, new language, have switched operating systems in the last year? Not many. How many of you switched databases in the last year? How many of you switched source code control systems in the last year? Yeah, somebody asked me. I think that's the only one where we switch a lot. I am currently using 4 different source code control systems. It does not make me happy. It makes me kind of grumpy. People like their tool sets, right? Every one of these, everyone changed a little bit. But it's not like everybody says, oh, yeah, I live to learn a new language. I live to learn a new tool set, right? We go there begrudgingly. And remember, our user's goal is not to help us. Our user's goal is to get their work done. We need to bring tools to them in their environment. And I think this is one of the places where we've all, universally, all of us have messed up in that we've tried to give them solutions in things they're not using. Yeah?
So Morgan, do you think it's all about startup cost and adoption? Or do people also have concerns about the extra overhead of the system doing something? Like if you're running experiments, are people concerned that having a provenance capture system in the background will impact those results?
So the answers I've gotten for people, so people always ask the question, oh, but how much space does that take up and how much does it slow down? So they ask that question. If you can give them an answer in the 10 to 15% and back it up with the data that we've collected without capturing provenance for, then they seem okay with that. That doesn't seem to be a bottleneck. Then the next thing is, okay, what do I have to do? In the moment I say, well, install our current, you know, that's when it becomes a non-starter. So their initial reaction is, this would be great. And they ask the question about whether it's going to slow them down. But they're pretty OK with a teeny bit of slowdown and overhead. Particularly the space thing doesn't bother them at all. The performance one, they need to make sure it's not going to go 10 times slower. But if you can give them, 10, 15, 20% slower, they're actually fine with that. At least that's been my reaction with people. It's that next startup cost. And I think on our part, I can't speak for other groups, I think on our part, we need to make that next step forward, really understand what they want, and build them a solution that works for them. You know, using whatever tools we want, but we need to take that step. Thinking they're going to take the step, I think, is where we've made the mistake. And I can make lots of excuses for it, but I think that's what we need to do. Val?
Should I read this line that you
do not mean, should I read this slide, that you do not mean standalone tools, but you mean integrating provenance features in existing environments?
Maybe. I think it's going to be very dependent on exactly who you're talking to and who you want to work with. So I think the answer is that as research prototypes, we need to build something that we can experiment with and that stands alone. And then there's another step we need to make, which we need to figure out how to couple it into their environment in a way that is painless to them. I think the problem is we're making them hurt. And they don't want to hurt, so they ignore us. So I don't think it's an architecture thing that you have to embed right away, but I think we need to understand that we have to embed and then figure out the right way to do it. If I can do it with a standalone tool but make it invisible to my users, then I'm fine. So it's a little bit of a case-specific thing what the exact right answer is, in my opinion. By the way, this is all my opinion. You guys can tell me I am totally full of it, and that's fine, because then you'll have to give me another excuse as to why we haven't achieved world domination, and that will lead to a discussion, and that's great. As I said, my goal here is to incite controversy. Friendly interfaces. So as soon as I say this, people say, yeah, we really need GUIs. No. We need interfaces that are friendly to our users. For example, one of the groups we shadowed, they were total command line weenies. They never used a GUI in their life, and they prided themselves on that. You know what they wanted? They wanted an option to find. They wanted to be able to say find, and they could type in way more complicated find expressions. Find is the Unix command that does a recursive search through a directory structure and will match things. Right? So they wanted an option to find that was like, find me the ancestors, find-ancestors foo. And they wanted to see all the ancestors of a file. Find-descendants bar. Yeah, this is not a hard interface. In fact, we started building this tool, actually. We started building extensions to find, and then we never went back to the scientists and said, hey, we've got something for you. Duh. Part of the reason is that they didn't want to run our kernel module to collect the data that would have enabled them to do these commands. But on our system, we could actually do them. They kind of work. Extending find, way, way, way easier than building a fancy front-end GUI, which we also went and did, which no one uses. Okay, so we need to figure out what kind of interface works for them. Might not be a GUI. It might be a GUI. There are people who like GUIs. But web browser's a really nice interface. And sometimes the command line is fine. So if you pick and choose the people you want to play with, they might like command lines, and then you don't have to do fancy user interface design. And that's okay. The bottom line is one size doesn't fit all. Figure out who you want to target, who you actually want to sit down and use your tool, and then give them something they like. So one of the groups we followed around was a bioanthropology group. And what they do is they go to Africa and they collect plants and fruits and berries and things, and they grind them up into powders, and then they analyze them. And the lifetime of their experiments are measured in decades. Decades. Okay? Let's think about the standard workload. When we talk about provenance stores, the standard workload finishes in a minute and a half. There's a big difference between collecting provenance for a minute and a half and collecting provenance for a decade. We don't think in those terms. So all you people, and there are those of you here, and Peter Buneman, this is for you, who make fun of PASS because we collect so much data and no one else has to worry about all this data we collect, sure, you can collect a lot less data. But after a decade, you have as much as we've been talking about. So the scale problems that we've been saying we need to tackle if we really want researchers to use us, and I don't expect you to hold your publications for a decade while these guys finish their work, okay? Not asking you that. But we do need to realize that provenance isn't this, it's not this one-off thing that you run a workload, you have provenance for that workload, and then you're done. It doesn't work that way. You run an experiment, you produce more data. Actually, the physics guys are a great example of this. So they run an experiment at CERN, and they produce gazillion data files of enormous size. So they're producing petabytes a minute, a lot of data. Then they have tier 1, tier 2, tier 3 data centers, and the data goes through all sorts of processing before it goes to each of these data centers. And then for the next decade, people do experiments on that data and on derived data. So you know, by the time these students finish their PhDs, the thing they're publishing has a lineage that is 10 years old and really big and bushy and really deep and long and really big. So even if you don't want your paper to take 10 years to write, and I would discourage you from the 10-year paper, maybe, but you need to realize that in order for the province to be useful, it really does have to stick around. It's got to continue to be useful, and it's going to continue to grow. It doesn't go away. And I think we sometimes forget about that. Go ahead, Val. Actually, so I'm so let's use the physicists. Let's actually use the physicists as an example, because I have come to respect them a huge amount since I've been doing Provenance. So they were actually the community I had in my head when I started doing this. It's like, oh my God, they have this huge data problem, and I was so arrogant that I thought I could help them. The physicists are actually incredible. So let me tell you a little bit about the physicists. And I'm thinking the high energy physicists. They have, number one, they have some of the most horrific code you've ever seen. But it works. And they still use it, and they all use it. So they have a package called Root, which is kind of the lowest level of the software that you use to manipulate their files. And they maintain it as a community, and they track it. And I don't know when their format changed, but what they've done, and I found this totally mind-boggling, I had a couple of physics graduate students take a data management course. So what they have are they have all these flat files. And on top of that, they've built a dynamic object model. So they have, and I think this is part of the Root system, if I got it correctly, that will take any of their flat files, and you tell it which fields you're interested in, and it sort of automatically and dynamically generates you objects, like C++ objects that you then manipulate, that have exactly the fields you want. It is horrific to get this to work, but they've done it, and it works. And so that means that new data formats, there might be slight tweaks to Root to process the data, but they kind of make it work. So that's the number one thing that the physicists are amazing at. They really do have this data that's been around for 10 years. They keep using it, and they're not dumb. And number two, the rigor with which they track their processing. So they have a central repository where you get to check in code. But you only get to check in code if you can prove that it works. And I forget exactly the mechanism, but you know, it has to work with the current version of Root that you say it's supposed to work with. And there's a reproducibility test to make sure that it actually does this. So all these things that we've been talking about, they actually eat, live, and breathe. And they don't do it using anything we've built. So yes, it's not easy. Completely agree with that. But I think it's a cop-out for us to say, oh, technology changes too fast. We can't think about the long term. Because people do accumulate data, and they're going to keep it. And they're not going to change its format. No one actually takes their format from 5 years ago and then turns it into the new format today. They just keep using the tools. So yes, it's non-trivial, but I think we can do better. Okay. Yes. Yeah. They do a lot of stuff by hand. And so one of the questions is, so these bioanthropologists, the observation is, you know, we can't come in and change their workflow, yet they still want what we want to offer them, so how do we put it into their workflow? And that's what I mean about, you know, getting up close and intimate with the science. We need to actually understand what they're doing. So this was sort of the insurance argument, which I think is a very real one. And I think it means that our job is harder. It's not that people are going to clamor a priori and say, I need this. They're going to go, oh, darn, I needed that last week. I wish that had been running. So that makes our job a little tricky. But it does mean we need to give them tools that are painless enough to use, that they're willing to adopt it, even if it's this abstract payoff down the road. And that that requires a mental shift. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If something goes wrong, if you need to figure something out, then you can trace it back. I wonder if there are disciplines where the fact that you have provenance could lead you to more discoveries in your field rather than offering this insurance. Could this be something that could be done?
So I actually think that's a really, really interesting question. So I think the answer is undoubtedly yes. I have this fantasy in my head. I've become a machine learning wannabe. And so I have this fantasy in my head that some of the ML people say, oh yeah, that's cool, and some people say, oh, we've already done it. So who knows what the truth is. But there's all this excitement about machine learning. Right? Everybody wants to do big data, it's all machine learning. So it seems to me that none of the machine learning algorithms are perfect. And I've always had this notion in my head that when you do your training on your learner, you could keep provenance. And that would, I'm talking about the internal process that's going on while you train. Then, when you actually get test data that you get wrong, in addition to just feeding that back into your learner and saying, oh, here's a sample, you got it wrong, I'm convinced that if you went back and said, okay, what's the provenance that led me to the wrong decision for this item, and what's the provenance that produced the learner, in my gut of guts, I am totally convinced that there's actually something really important there. Like I said, some machine learning people go, oh yeah, and other people say, oh, that's online learning, we already do it. And I don't know enough about machine learning to be able to tease that apart. So that's a case where I absolutely believe there's value in the provenance that's different than just insurance. My suspicion is that there is, and this is actually an interesting approach that I haven't thought of until just now, but all this crowdsourcing and data mining that these companies are doing for purposes that are perhaps not as high-minded as discovering the Higgs boson, but like selling you guys more things, they do a lot of data mining. And it seems to me that they could probably make more money if they had provenance that they could mine too, just because they seem to make more money whenever they mine something new. So I think you're right. And I think it means figuring out the right user. I don't think it's our science friends. Necessarily. I think it might be our business friends, and that might be a better place to look. So I think that's a really interesting approach, and I don't have, you know, I don't have any experience there, but I think you're onto something. Support, if we actually want people to do this, we need to be responsive. We all know that. So here's actually a concrete thing that I'll come back to. We don't have a visibility as a community, right? You know, security community, they have cert. There are other communities that have like a presence. We don't really have a presence. If you want to learn more about provenance, if you want to know what's out there, you're kind of left to Googling. So maybe we could actually do something here. And I'm going to come back to that in just a minute or two because I'm almost there. Hello. It'd be nice. Okay. And I think we have to have an open mind. And I like a lot of the questions. I think they demonstrate that people are willing to sort of engage in this conversation. So the key thing is that our customers, our users actually know what they want more than we know what they should want. And it's some back and forth, right? They will describe it one way, we might think of it another, but we need to really listen to them. So here's a challenge I would like to offer this crowd as we think about, will there be a TAP 14? What should we do? What are we doing with all the questions we always think about? So here's an event that I would love to see a group of us do. Let's pull together 10 provenance weenies. No offense intended, I consider myself one, but you know, 10 people like us. Let's pull together 10 users who say, yeah, I would love to have this if you gave me the right thing. And then let's lock ourselves in a room until we can come to an agreement that we, the provenance weenies, will give them something. And they agree that if we give them that something, they will actually use it. And we can pick and choose our users very carefully. We can decide exactly who we want. But I think this would actually be cool. I think it would be really instructive. I think it could push us ahead a lot to actually get some real people using. We're doing cool stuff. We're doing cool stuff. But it's kind of not getting out there yet. Yeah, Ashish. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, everyone must use your own tools. And I, well, I just am taking it as a given that you're all going to go home and start using your own tools. Right? Yeah, okay. I'm working on it. I'm working on it. I hope to have progress on this front. So there's the challenge. So I would claim that here's where we want to be. These are the slides from my 2019 retrospective, right? That we've deployed real systems and others use them. We have a nice formal framework for describing it. There's this huge security nightmare, and we've addressed that. So here's where we need to be in another 6 years. Okay, so there's where we want to be. And then here's where we want to be on sort of the standardization. We need to be patient, right? I think we need to let this evolve so we know what to standardize, because I don't think we know yet. And eventually we'll get there. But here's sort of where we are today. So I'm frustrated as somebody who believes deeply in this area and this community and thinks we're actually really doing cool stuff. I'm frustrated. So here's the call to action. Let's hold the challenge, or something like it. Very different than these other provenance challenges. This is really a user-focused challenge. And I would like to see us form a community. Like, maybe it's a website where we all agree that we'll write a blog entry once a year, right? There are 20 or 30 or 40 people in this community, maybe 50. You know, once a year, if each of us wrote a blog entry, we'd have a weekly blog. That would be cool. We could put together links to our page. We could actually, like, tell the world we exist and tell them why they should care. That might not be a bad idea. So I don't think this has to be a huge effort, but I think it would be cool. And then we'd have a place to publish our success stories, because we'd start generating them, because people would come to us and say, ooh, of all the things you're talking about, this seems closest to what I want. Will you work with me? And so before the next tap, I want to see us in the New York Times. I would prefer it be a positive article, but as it turns out, no press is bad press. And so a negative article would be okay too. But I would prefer the positive one, right? But the one that says, oh, this horrible disaster happened and they have no idea why because they didn't have the data that told them, that's the one I'm not interested in seeing. So even if it's, well, we had the provenance and it was really hard and tedious and it took us 3 weeks to figure it out, that would be okay. And I think it's really important that we address some of this, because lots of other communities are going to be vying for all those research dollars that now just got cut through sequestration. And we need to be in the middle of this. And everybody you talk to kind of says it's important. But why are there 28 of us in here and, oh, Casey's gone, you know, 250 of them in there? You know, they're doing network systems. Network systems have been around for a while. Yeah, they're important. But they're actually not as, you know, fundamental as us, right? So I hope I've made at least some of you mad or inspired or angry or elicited some kind of emotional reaction. We have time to take questions, or I'd like it to be a conversation if we can. If you want to throw things at me, that's okay too. Yeah?
This was just a quick kind of a fact thing. You said there was one provenance product. I'm not quite sure what you meant by that, because there are lots of products that include provenance.
So, yes. So for example, you know, Word includes provenance, right? I can go back and find my history. So you're right. So I was construing that term very narrowly. So you're correct. But are there any tools that collect provenance that actually let me do things? Well, and actually, so now that I'm thinking through this, right, Word is actually a great example. And yet, if you asked the Word designers, do you do provenance? I think they'd say no. So that's an interesting observation, right? There are people who do history tracking. So here's the question to you. Is there a difference between history tracking, a la Word, and what we do as a community? I'm guessing most of us want the answer to be yes. But is all we're doing just fancy logging? What do you think?
I think it depends on how we define what we do as a community.
Fair enough.
But things like workflow systems. I mean, I know you sort of want to differentiate that from other provenance systems, but they do traditionally include provenance. So
they do, like, include
Kepler,
provenance. But what I really want to know is how many of the people who use those systems ever use it, And I actually tried to find some data on that, and it's hard to get your hand. It'd be interesting to do sort of a survey of people who use, you know, Kepler or VizTrails or any of these, and actually figure out, do they use these? Do they even know the capabilities are there? So do they not use them because they don't know that? Do they use them? If they don't, do they not use them because they don't know they're there? Or do they not use them because they don't do exactly the right thing? And so I ended up adopting a student who had inadvertently gone off and built a Python-based workflow engine. And it was a very narrow view in that the one thing they were trying to do with the provenance, the reason they built the workflow engine was actually to do a very specific application of provenance, and that application was dependency tracking, so you knew exactly what you needed to rerun when something changed. So it was basically make for Python, but automatic, you never had to write a make file. And it was really interesting because the people who developed it loved it, they used it all the time, but they were embedded in a biology lab, they built it there, no one else in the lab used it, even though they were all writing in Python. There's something missing that I can't quite get my hand on.
In my lab, what we had luck doing was, instead of trying to sell them on the querying aspects of provenance, because that's a little abstract for them, we used provenance to speed execution or something, because everyone likes things to run faster.
Yep. So sort of like this dependency kind of thing where you don't have to rerun stuff, is that the idea?
Yeah. We sort of hooked them on that, and then at least they're using provenance.
Well, it was funny. It was either the first or the second tap, we had a talk by Philip Guo, who had done InkPy, which was essentially exactly the same strategy, which is it was incremental Python that did memoization, so when you change things, you didn't have to re-execute. And the scientists loved it, right? So there's a good concrete case where provenance is really useful, and we don't even call it provenance in those cases, right? He joked that he was at this theory and practice of provenance, and he gave a talk that never used the word provenance anywhere. So maybe it's just we need to reorient ourselves to how we think about it. Thank you. I think those are great points to bring up. Yes, Age, go for it.
So I'm actually going to get off my soapbox a little bit.
Oh, please.
And I'm actually going to hang on Margo's coattails a little bit, because it's something she expressed, but she didn't actually say outright. And I would posit that one of the biggest problems for people adopting these systems, the provenance usage, even ourselves, and it's actually something that Val brought up with his question about ever-changing systems over a 10-year period, is the capture side of things, right? So right now, all of our research is very focused on the OS level. There's a few libraries out there that capture things at a higher level, right? There's a few that plug into Python, there's ES3 to Java, right? These are very low-level capture points, right? And so the provenance you get out of it are openings of files, closings of files. You're not actually getting what the user is doing on these files. So if you actually look at an Excel spreadsheet, you see that you've opened that Excel spreadsheet, but you're not, and closed it. But you haven't noticed that you've reordered some columns, and oops, you forgot to select the third column, so when you sorted, suddenly your columns are all jumbled in terms of your results, right? So, my challenge, in addition to these many things, is we either need to find a way to do a mapping from these low-level OS calls to something that is actually of interest and usable to the people in the end, or to define better capture points that are in the tools or easily integratable into the tools that we're actually using, like Word and Excel, and higher-level, that create these higher-level objects that people actually understand and use.
Cool.
Not much of a question, but...
No. I soapboxes are good, too. So actually, there was a really fascinating talk I saw just this week, and it's a woman who considers herself an HCI designer, sort of in the HCI graphic spectrum. But what she'd done is she'd built a way to automatically produce tutorials for how to do stuff by, like, looking at videos online. So basically, you know, searching for stuff that exists, and then from that, constructing these tutorials. And part of what she did was she would take advantage of tools like Photoshop that keeps a history of what you've done. And then she would use those to actually reverse engineer what are the things you need to teach people. And I thought, wow, that's sort of a provenance application. So, and it's a provenance application that works at a capture point, which is 100% aligned with what the users of that tool are doing. So yeah, I kind of agree with you. No, I completely agree with you, not even kind of. Yeah, won't you?
So I've been ruminating about your slides, and I think one of the, well, you know, there might be this gap between research and development in general, right? So when you have a research idea, it takes a few years to come out, crystallize it, solidify it, and then it takes another team of developers, at least with my limited experience in industry, to make this idea usable by end users. So we have been more on the research side in terms of provenance research and less on making the tools available and usable by the community. And that may be one problem. Now, the other comment, I just want to add a remark. When Peter Sanjeev and I were working on Why and Where, we were certainly not thinking about world domination, or at least not to my understanding.
Oh, Peter was. Peter was.
So.
No, I'm curious, at least for subsequent research, whether any of the researchers like Val, whether he was thinking of world domination with his
In latter research, we were thinking of figuring out something that would work for the orchestra data sharing system. And I'm ashamed to say, yeah, so, you know, we built it, but I'm not using it. Even worse, okay, if you don't tell Zach, I says, I don't think he's using it either, and he's much more responsible for the whole thing. So Margo is right. I don't know if I can segue in right away.
I do want to say something, because I think there is, so I went pretty far on the sort of productization side. I'm not really talking shrink-wrapped, we can sell it to, you know, your grandfather. So I think there's a middle ground, which in companies call it maybe advanced development. So I don't think we need to build tools that are flawless and ready for prime time. But if you do systems-y kind of stuff, and I think provenance has this formal component that's really valuable, but it's also a systems-y kind of thing too. The question is where you decide done is. And personally, for me, I'm frustrated because I think we've sold ourselves and our community short by defining done at the papers and not done a little bit more work to get people using it. I'm not talking about turning it into a product, right? If companies wanted to do that, great. If people want to hire you a way to do startups, that's fabulous. I don't think we need to get all the way there, but there's this big gap in the middle. And I'd like to see us push a little bit more there so that it's more obvious just how relevant what we've done is. So I think there's a bunch of really cool work in this community, and most of the world, including our colleagues in computer science and including the people who kind of want what we do, don't see it as relevant. And it's that last part that bugs me, right? There are people out there who say every day, I would love to have this, and yet I haven't seen you do anything that actually helps me get there. So I think there's a middle ground, and I'm hoping there's a way we can figure out how to get a little bit further without having to go hire a dozen developers. But you're right, it's hard. It's really hard. Oh, good, lots of hands. So I'm going to try to call on people who haven't spoken yet, but you have the mic, so you should go. Actually, Joey will move the mic around, then I won't have to decide.
So, as a representative of the security community, if you'd like to be more like the security community, you're going to need more FUD. Lots of FUD. FUD sells.
Well, we can do that in Providence, right? The financial crisis was our opportunity. I'm sure there'll be another one. In fact, my own institution seems to have one of those right now. So I'm good on the FUD front.
But to call out to your Unix tool side, and in general, this call of eating your own dog food. So in the security community, the industry security community, they have Backtrack Linux, which is now renamed Kali Linux, I believe. But this is this OS that they've developed, it's basically become a key tool for the field for pen testers and other security auditing individuals. So in the area of provenance then, what about the idea of choosing some LTS, Ubuntu, maybe Red Hat, I don't know, some long-term support, stable distribution? Everybody seems to have either Python tools, system libraries. Most academic researchers in a computing area, we tend to develop for Linux because it's available. Well, divert or move all the efforts into a unified platform. you can choose Unix distribution. The concerted effort puts all the tools on this distribution. You can release the distribution. People can install it and try out the tools. It would be easy then to run. You would be running your own distribution. You could develop the tools in the distribution you're currently developing on. And that forces you to make things usable because, of course, eventually when you're writing software and your Provenance system is currently doing something that really makes you angry, you're going to have to fix it if you're going to want to continue your work. I was wondering, what do you think of that as a potential proposal?
So I love the vision, but that's kind of where we started. And as a research group in a university with, you know, a handful of graduate students, we can't support our own distribution. And so, you know, we started out using, you know, a nice up-to-date version of Linux, and now we're, you know, years out of date.
But, what I'm thinking is we've got, maybe 15 research faculty in the room, research faculty industry researchers, mm-hmm. and with grad students are a great cheap workforce. So pooling resources might make that problem a little easier.
Yeah, I love the vision. I'm really skeptical because most of this community are not OS hackers. So we have things on both sides of the aisle, so let's make sure we don't short shrift those guys too.
So I like this idea about the insurance. So the other stuff is just, you know, things that we all know, maybe we try to forget them sometimes, right? But about this insurance aspect, I like the idea of, you know, we need to sell Provenance to some vendors. Once a vendor integrates this, a lot of people get this for free, and we have basically the development aspect outsourced, right? Like doing the last few steps that Rakshu said, you know, mm-hmm. is we might not have the time for, right? So I think that's really important, and we haven't thought too much about that, right? Like how we go to Google, Facebook, Oracle, and tell them, you know, here, you know.
Yeah, wouldn't you love a provenanced web? Right? Wouldn't it be great if when you got a document you could say, okay, where did this come from? There are so many times I would love that. And Wikipedia history is great, but it's not quite there.
I was actually going to mention exactly that you just said. So, yeah. So if you want the New York Times level time of attention, then the, you know, provenance enabling the web is one good way to get that. But I see it's been very hard. So, because, the two points of catch were, as Adrian mentioned, so one is completely automatic, and you get a lot of it, and maybe you can actually certify that it's genuine, mm-hmm. or it's manual, so people volunteer, but then the problem you have is completely fabricated for all you know, right? So to me, that is a nagging problem. And then I'm not sure how you instrument this "oh yeah" button that, you know, that is in everybody's mind. How do we implement this "oh yeah" button that is behind every page? That will make you the headlines, but I see substantial problems with that. Because, you know, if I write a blog and I want to be honest about it, I say, yes, these paragraphs come from that blog, but there's no one really, I mean, there's lots of instrumenting that needs to be in place before that happens behind the scenes, unless I volunteer that information. So. Any thoughts on how far we are from that?
So there's two kinds of provenance. There's, I don't have a name for these, right? There's mental provenance, which is the latter category that you were talking about that, you know, I can't capture unless I put a cable in your brain, right? So the fact that, well, I'm going to back off on that in a minute. But so there's this mental provenance, which is, oh, I read an article 6 weeks ago, and I'm going to steal from it, right? So, okay, I'm willing to let that go for a while. There's still all this other stuff that really did come from somewhere. So the work of Chris Ray at Wisconsin is actually pretty interesting because he's done some of this, which is that he builds these, you know, he learns stuff from things on the web and he actually relates them to where they came from. So when he decides that Barack Obama is actually the president of the United States, you can actually click on that and here are the 17 news articles that said, you know, President Barack Obama, you know, POTUS, Barack, and it shows you the provenance. And I saw that and said, oh, that's really cool. Now, that's a small piece of a bigger system, but in some domains, I think we can do that. In some, we can't. So I don't want to let the great be the enemy of the good. Let's do what we can. And I love the concept of an "oh yeah" button. It's like I'm sitting there thinking, okay, so you could build that and jump in. I like that. That's really great.
I was going to raise kind of a opposition to the idea of a provenance Linux distribution, which is surely, given what you were saying about users' problems with level of adoption, if we can barely persuade people to install tools, how are we ever going to get them to install a Linux distribution? I don't know, just as a point opposing the Linux distribution model.
Yeah, so you know, if it were really good and it got the buzz, then I think people would do it, because people do install their favorite Linux distribution. Not me, but people do. And also, I will confess, I've become a huge fan of virtual machines this year. We're using them in my course. So packaging up, it doesn't even have to be a full distribution. Packaging up tools in a virtual machine that people could use, so I think this is actually much more likely. And then if we wanted to start changing the operating system in that virtual machine, we could. But I think getting them to use a virtual machine and play with it might actually be a way to start dabbling in some of these areas. So, you know, if I go back to this idea of let's actually coalesce into a community, right? Let's start small. Let's have a virtual machine that we install our tools on. And maybe we use not only our own tools, but other people's tools as well, right? That might be kind of cool. So I think there are steps we can take. And if ultimately a decade from now we have our own distribution, that'll be fine, because we will have already convinced the world. But I think thinking out of the box, right? I hadn't thought of the VM thing until just now. But his comment followed by your comment says, well, there's a middle ground. Oh, I just had an evil thought. Oh, I just had a really interesting thought. So, okay, so this is real-time design. So Harvard has started teaching its intro computer science as an edX course, which means we had, you know, 100,000 people. The whole course is taught on a virtual machine. We could potentially, if it didn't break the machine, but as a community, we could actually instrument that virtual machine in interesting ways, and we could potentially capture provenance on hundreds of thousands of users and how they learn. It's not science, it's not Library of Congress, it's not marketing, it's education, which I'm guessing everybody in this room has at least some interest in. So there's a platform, and I know the guy who does it. So if people have tools or things that you would like, you know, let's talk. Just a thought.
You need to make sure they know that we
can. So part of the deal is they already know. So we already track all their clicks and everything else. So part of the philosophy behind the edX platform is that it's specifically a tool on which to do research about how people learn. So as long as we, you know, we wouldn't, the data sharing agreements and everything would need to be in place, but we already track them in many ways, and so tracking them inside the virtual machine would actually be okay.
So as a call for action, what do you think of including system demonstration as a first-class entity as part of future TAPS? I don't know for the previous TAPS it was there or not, but then at least people can demonstrate their systems, and those of us here who want to try those out can see how they are to be used.
I think it's a great idea. Cool. Somebody write that down. I feel like I'm
so,
being
in the same spirit of the last few questions, we had actually a brief discussion in one of the sessions yesterday about impact versus research output, and so I would like to hear your thoughts on that, because obviously all of us would love to have impact, but the way we prioritize things may be driven by different incentives. And also, let me also add an extra note to that. I've been talking to people in some other disciplines, for example, software engineering, who tend to have somewhat an easier time often having impact in the mm-hmm. big players. And they were telling me that the features that actually end up being implemented and adopted really in the product are things that were published 10, 15 years ago, and it's not really the latest and greatest. Companies need to really dumb down functionality in order to make something happen. So how do we you know, in view of all of this, what should we do?
So those are great questions. I think, so there, I'll separate them. Let me answer the second one first, because I think there's a shorter answer. So it is true that many of the things that get added are old technology, but I think in some sense, I was talking about this talk, this woman who'd done this work of automatically generating the tutorials, and she'd been working in Photoshop, and lo and behold, some of her graduate work is already in Photoshop. So there are companies, so I think if you hit the sweet spot that is something that can be packaged for a user, I don't think it has to be the 10-year delay. It'd be interesting to try to understand why that 10-year delay happens. I think internships are one of the greatest way to expedite that process. So I think it's possible to work around that if we hit on the right things. This other question about how we evaluate faculty and how you weight impact, what does impact mean? And unfortunately, that's a totally institution-specific question. So it took us 20 years, but my engineering school understands that software artifacts actually count more than, an SOSP paper, right? Like an artifact that people use is actually a big deal. But it took us 20 years to teach them that. And if you're in a department that hasn't learned that yet, then you have to be strategic about how they evaluate it. So I think in some sense, those of us who are more senior need to be the flag bearers, and we need to make sure that we can move the community forward without jeopardizing any of the junior people. I think that's really important. So part of it is, so there's a conversation both at the CRA and the CCC, which is the Community Computing Consortium. I can never remember what the 3Cs stand for. So there's a conversation actually about the publishing culture and the fact that we've moved almost exclusively to a conference-based publication culture and away from the journal culture, and that we've lost something in that process. And in some sense, we've lost some of the depth and the ability to do longer-term work, where maybe you turn out one journal paper in a year, but it actually is a huge paper that has impact, and maybe there's a more mature artifact than you would have had you published 4 conference papers. So the community is starting to talk about that, and I think this plays directly in with that, but we're not there yet. And so, I would give Val a lot more grief about what he's doing than I would give you about what you should be doing. And I think, each of us has to assess our own situation and be strategic about it and still play with the community and figure out how to move us all forward.
Discussing the importance of journal versus conference papers is happening everywhere now.
Yeah, it really is. It's starting to explode.
So it's not, in fact, input from people like you would be useful for my department. I don't know about vice versa, but people are sort of grasping for sort of wise counsel from, because we're not quite sure exactly what should be precisely our stance. Our stance has changed dramatically in 10 years. We were much more standard. We were much more sort of traditional about it.
Right.
Every conference paper better be journalized and so on, but this has changed.
Absolutely.
And the question is, how far should it change? Should it go all the way over? Nothing should be journalized and so on.
And actually, the thing that got me to thinking about that is that the whole, I hate to ascribe too much importance to a single white paper, but Dave Patterson wrote this incredibly influential white paper in something like 1993 that still sits on the CRA website that basically says, in systems, conference publications count, and they should count as much as journal publications. And this, this document, and my tenure case was made on it, I'm grateful for it, and I think it made sense at the time. So the reason I actually thought of that is that in some sense, there is a possibility to be influential in saying, okay, sorry, we were wrong. It's not all about conference papers. And I think in some sense there's this triumvirate, right? There are conference papers, there are journal papers, and there are software artifacts in some fields, not all fields, but in some fields. And the question is, and the conversation should be about, how do we evaluate those three things and wrap it together, and how do we counsel more junior faculty to be strategic in how they think about those three things? So that's a conversation that is way beyond the scope of this community, but I think it's one we could actually have input in. And it occurs to me, I'm hoping to be off the CCC in the next year, but if I'm not, or even if I am, this would be the kind of project that would be interesting to take to CCC and say, this is one of the conversations that we think needs to happen around this publication arena, because the software artifact issue has not come into the discussion, and I think it should. So this has been a great conversation.
This is an excellent talk, and I would like to bring an example in which similar sort of questions have been raised, and this is the NSF-funded EarthCube effort. It's for geoscientists, and it's been like 2 decades where computer scientists and cyber infrastructures people have been building the cyber infrastructure, which geoscientists have not used. And people have come to the point where they say that none of our needs are being solved. And I mean, they have had so many complaints that NSF actually took it upon themselves that they are going to do something to solve their needs. So for the past 2 years, they have been having these workshops, and you know, to bring geoscientists, really like people who have, you know, exactly data in Excel sheets and files and, you know, no fancy cyber infrastructure, and they actually want them to sit down and do simple commands for them so that they can manage the data. And one of the things that came out through that effort, which I particularly think is a very positive, is what the federal agencies are doing is a RCN, a research coordination network, in which actually the idea is not to build anything, but to come up with roadmaps and drafts where there are needs of the cyber infrastructure people which are mentioned and possible solutions. And then they are doing this matchmaking service where you are actually saying that I have this expertise or I have built this software product which can be matched with the needs of the geoscientists. And I think these two things, which are still in, I mean, we don't know what the end result is going to be, but they seem very promising to me.
And it sounds like this community should be engaged in that process.
I think so. And I think this RCN idea, in which there are a lot of discussions that happen, really helps to iron out the main requirements of the end users rather than you know, what cyber infrastructure people are thinking about. So maybe we can suggest federal agencies to have a provenance-based RCN. I mean, there is a semantics-based RCN because there have been so many ontologies and things like that over there, and there is no understanding what that means. So they've been doing an RCN on semantics. And everyone realizes that that's useful, but
that's
nobody uses it.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
So maybe something which really refers to what you just said. There is this digital preservation community that also focus on preserving the data for a long time, and they care about keeping the formats up to date, about storing them. So first thought that they have is when they are, for example, transforming some formats, they can also care about provenance that goes along with that format. And second, the transformation itself should generate the new provenance data. So I think there are now some projects ongoing about digital preservation, and it should not be underestimated. We should also remember about this.
So that's absolutely right. I get pinged by those communities. The digital preservation people, they get provenance. They're one of those communities that go, yeah, we really get this. And what's interesting about that community is they are willing to do everything they need to do manually. They are completely willing to do it. And so they appreciate the potential of automation, and they're very excited about it. But until it does exactly what they want, they're going to keep doing it manually, because they've actually been doing provenance longer than any of us. And they know exactly what they want. But they are exactly a ripe community that gets what we want to do and can provide really good roadmaps and guidance, I think. Val.
Why don't we start small with a blog?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
I'm totally jazzed about that idea.
You are definitely our leader.
I don't know about that.
Yes, I mean.
but I do know how to start a blog.
I think you should, you know, get somebody to set up a blog somewhere. I don't know.
I know how to do that.
I'm not so good at that. But I promise to write an entry in that blog as soon as possible.
Okay, how many people would be willing to write a blog entry in the next year? Doesn't have to be long. Good. Okay. So Usenix has permission to give me all your email addresses so I can bug you. Okay, and the other thing I'm thinking, this challenge or an activity like it. So I was thinking that that's the kind of thing we could probably get some kind of CCC or NSF funding. So let's get the blog started first. We'll be engaging the TAP steering committee. So we need to make this event a little bit bigger. I think we need to get the community actually jazzed. And next year's an IPAW year, so we need to figure that out as well. So we have some strategic issues that we need to address, but we can do a blog.